From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox. President Barack Obama says he'll sign a $410 billion spending bill, but says earmark reforms are in the works. Plus, Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke says fix the banks to save the economy. And when should President Obama move his focus from domestic to foreign policy? Joining me now to discuss this week's political stories, Mary Frances Berry, Professor of History at the University of Pennsylvania, and Robert Trainum, the D.C. Bureau Chief for the Comcast Network CN8. Robert, Mary, nice to have you.
Hello, Tony. Thanks for having us.
Let's begin with this. The Senate voting to pass a $410 billion spending bill that includes thousands of controversial earmarks. Robert, one of the sticking points, as we say, are those earmark projects. But here's my question. The president is justifying allowing these projects, although he spoke out very vociferously against them during his presidential campaign. As you know, earmarks are part of the infrastructure of Congress. Can he really reform this process?
He can try, as every president has tried to do. He can campaign, as every presidential campaign has tried to do, which is to say no more earmarks. They need to go through the proper appropriations channel. They should not be inserted into the budget in a line item. But, you know, what I find interesting about all of this, Tony, is that all throughout the presidential campaign, the Obama campaign and the president himself, now President Obama, has said, I will not sign earmarks into law. They have to go through the appropriate appropriations channel. And here he is signing a legislative bill that has earmarks in it. Now, of course, the Obama spin is that this is leftover business from the Bush administration. That's disingenuous. It's technically correct. Yes, this is leftover business from the previous administration. However, he is now in control, and the Democrats are in control, obviously, of the House and the Senate. So he does have the power to tell the Democrats, give me a clean bill, scrub this bill clean, send me a bill that is clean. He didn't do that.
Well, maybe he has that. Go ahead, Mary. Does he have that power?
With all due respect, I think that all of what Robert said is true, but it's probably irrelevant. The point is that a campaign is a campaign. He's also served in the Congress, and he knows how important earmarks are to legislators. And legislators insert earmarks at the behest of their people who vote for them and give them campaign contributions. And, in fact, there's no way to stop them. Also, if you're president, you don't like earmarks because you would like to be in control of what's in the budget and how the money is spent. If you're Congress, you want to have some say-so representing the people in your districts. Also, the reforms of saying openly what they are, putting them on the websites and the like, will be fine. Most earmarks, in fact, go for nonprofits and for universities and all kinds of places for important things. And there's no way legislators are going to give them up. And I think Obama understands that, which is why he said, all earmarks are not bad.
Well, they certainly have a process. In fact, some of the Democratic leadership has already posted some of the new requirements that they are going to try to get in place, having, for example, members to post all of their requests online, certify that there's no financial interest, having executive review, so on and so forth. One last thing on the earmarks. Actually, Robert, not just the earmarks, the budget itself or the spending bill itself has some other concerns, does it not, because of people like the chairs of the Senate and House Finance and Budget Committees and people like Charlie Rangel of Ways and Means and Henry Waxman over Energy and Commerce with regard to whether or not they are willing to give up some of their interests for the interest of the spending bill.
You're absolutely correct, Tony. And, you know, just to go back just very quickly, this is not about earmarks per se. It's about the process and understanding in the grand scheme of things that we are in a economic meltdown. And to the extent that you're going to ramrod a budget with earmarks out there, that's not a priority right now, and it should not be a priority. And the founders of our country put a process in place, i.e. the appropriations process, for earmarks to go through the process. To answer your question specifically, you know, every single member of Congress, particularly the chairman of jurisdiction, they need to prioritize. They need to scratch their heads and say, you know what, this is not a priority, but this is a priority. And it seems like as Mary had said a few moments ago, that every member of Congress is looking out for their own best interests as opposed to the country's best interests as a whole.
Now, Mary, staying with money and finance, the Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke spoke out yesterday saying that in order for the economy to recover, the financial system needs to be stabilized. And in the speech, he diagnosed the root of the economic crisis as, in his words, banks that are considered too big to fail and ad hoc financial structures, among other things. So here's my question. Isn't this kind of analysis from the Fed chairman a little late? AIG has already been bailed out, among others. Isn't this the kind of advice that should have preceded the bailout?
Right. All of his advice is late. The things he said about regulating credit swaps and derivatives and all of that is, these are things that should have been done before and weren't. And now we're in this mess. And here's the fundamental problem. The fundamental problem is that if you try to change the way financial institutions do business, they don't like it because to do business, they're in the business of trying to make money, and they don't like restraints. They want the money from the feds. But in fact, if you interfere with capitalism and the free enterprise way that they do things, who knows what will happen? And the government doesn't want to nationalize them, and people are getting impatient with giving them money over and over again to bail them out without any rules or regulations. So you have a conundrum there, which, as long as the administration isn't in the business of trying to nationalize anything, the banks feel, and the insurance companies and the like, the non-bank financial institutions, that they can keep asking for money. And they can keep functioning, and they can hold off the regulation.
When is the end game, Robert?
That's the million-dollar. That's the billion-dollar question. No one knows exactly when this is going to end. Look, the federal chairman is stuck between a rock and a hard place, because if he says something before the curve, then everyone's going to react to that and say that he's trying to create a panic. When he responds after the curve, they're saying he's too slow and he's not really relevant. So, you know, he has to be very careful what he says, because obviously his words have weight. One can make the argument even more weightier than the president when it comes to economic terminology. But what is the bottom? When are we going to stop this hemorrhaging? When are we going to start moving forward and stop spinning our wheels? No one knows the answer to that question, Tony.
All right, let's move on to foreign policy in the time that we have left. President Obama on Monday said that the United States should consider reaching out to members of the Taliban in Afghanistan to bring an end to tensions there. A similar tactic has been tried with the Sunni militants in Iraq. My question, Mary, for you is, former members of the CIA have warned against this. What do you say?
I say that good luck. The Afghanistan is not Iraq. That's the first thing. And we're seeing in recent days that the what's going on in Iraq, there's still violence and there's still dissidents and there's still a need for military. But I think it's worth a try if they think that they can do this. I had hoped that Obama would deal with other foreign policy issues, the crisis in Darfur, for example, by this time. I was disappointed to see that he has now kept the same rule for Haitian refugees to keep them out of this country instead of putting them in the same position as refugees from other places in Latin America. I was hoping he would deal with these issues. But on Afghanistan, the tough problem is that no one ever has won in Afghanistan who's tried. Any Western government, and even the Soviet Union, didn't win. And so reaching out might be okay, but the problem is who to reach out to. There are too many different tribes who have their own disagreements with each other, but good luck.
You know, what about relations, Robert, with Iran and Pakistan? Because with Iran especially, there seems to be some difference of opinion in how the president and the secretary of state want to deal with Iran's nuclear program. Obama seems to want talks. Clinton seems to suggest that that isn't necessarily a tenable way to go.
You know, Tony, I remember during the primaries when then Senator Clinton was debating Senator Obama, they had this conversation about Iran, and Senator Clinton said massive retaliation if, in fact, Iran was to get a nuclear weapon and they were to fire it first or first strike. Senator Obama kind of hesitated a little bit and said, you know what, we have to have a carrot and stick approach. We have to engage our enemies. And a lot of people, Republicans and even some Democrats, literally jumped down his throat and said that was very naive thinking. So it's very interesting to fast forward to today that President Obama is now in power and he's willing to reach out. But I agree completely with Mary. Who do you reach out to? Are these people are rational? Do they have the same interest that you have, which is world peace? Now, granted, that was in the context of Afghanistan, but I would actually make the argument that's also in the same context for Iran as well.
Let's end the conversation with this. We've got about 45 seconds or so for your answer, Mary, a little closer to home. Part of that $410 billion spending bill includes a lifting of travel restrictions to Cuba. That's interesting, isn't it?
I think it's great. I think it's about time, and I think that the best way to deal with Cuba is to let as many people who want to go there go there, and as many people who want to trade there. And many Cubans, even in Miami, Cuban Americans, are no longer willing to support the old policy of embargo. So I was happy to see that, and I would just like to see more of the restrictions removed.
You think it's the beginning of a new paradigm really quickly, Robert?
I think it's the beginning of perhaps the president hitting a beehive and hoping to God that he does not get stung. The question becomes, and I disagree with Mary on this, and the question becomes is whether or not there are Cuban Americans in Florida that truly do believe that this is the right policy. Some of the polling data that I have seen, that's not the case.
All right. And he also, by the way, is going to be going to Turkey to talk there. So we'll begin to see more, perhaps, of our new president's foreign policy in the days and weeks ahead. Mary, Robert, thank you both very much.
Thank you.
That was Mary Frances Berry, professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania and the former chair of the U.S. Civil Rights Commission, and Robert Trainum, the D.C. bureau chief for the Comcast network CN8, host of Roll Call TV, and a professor at George Washington University. He joined us from our NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C. I'm Tony Cox, and this is News and Notes. What do you do while you're on the web? There's some surprising new information about the evolving nature of how people use the Internet and what they use it for. We turn now to Jeffrey Bennett. He's the digital producer for News and Notes. Hey, Jeffrey.
Hey, Tony.
So what is the takeaway in this new report?
Well, social networks and blogs have moved ahead of personal emailing among the most popular online activities. And this is according to the Nielsen Company, which monitors consumer behavior. And they say time spent on these social networking sites is growing 3 times faster than the overall internet rate. And they say over 2/3 of the world's online population now visits social networking and blogging sites. But the issue now is how to fund these sites, right? Mm-hmm. So like Facebook, for example, has a huge audience, a growing audience, but has very relatively little obvious advertising compared to a site like MySpace, which is cluttered with ads but has seen their audience flatten. So it's a catch-22 for some of these sites.
Well, speaking of social networks, a hugely popular site, YouTube, is having issues overseas. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, Google, which owns YouTube, said Monday it would block users in the UK from watching music videos on the site after negotiations with Britain's music royalty collecting agency fell apart. So as it worked at present, record labels in the UK would provide YouTube with what they call premium or official music videos, and then YouTube would then pay a royalty to the writers and publishers of those songs based on the viewing popularity of those clips. But the license expired, and neither side can come to terms with the best financial agreement. So, again, it's all about the money, and then YouTube just restricted access to
users. You know, this talk about Facebook and YouTube brings us to another kind of online service, Jeffrey. Legacy Locker. What is that?
It's an interesting concept. It's a will for your online life, right? So much in the same way you would transfer a savings account or a car upon your death, now you can do the same thing with a PayPal account or an online photo album or something like that. It's a company called Legacy Locker, as you said. And for $30 a year, you can transfer your passwords to your online account to a friend or a family member as you see fit. The issue, though, is the service is only as good as for as long as the site lasts. And since it's a startup, you know, it's anyone's guess how long it'll be around.
That's wild.
Yeah.
Switching gears, we have been talking on the show and online about the major economic woes facing Detroit. What's been the response on our blog?
Yeah, we were talking about the price of a home sold in Detroit going down to $7,500. And a reader named Deuce Bollards wonders, quote, "What will happen to the Lions, the Pistons, and Tigers? If they bite the dust, that will be the saddest part of this story." I don't necessarily agree. There's a lot of other sad stories other than Detroit sports teams going down.
You know.
But, you know, as our blog winds down in the show's final week, we have links to all of our network of bloggers, and those conversations will continue there.
All right, Jeff, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Jeffrey Bennett, the digital producer for News and Notes, joining me here in the studios of NPR West. Time now to see what other stories are heating up the blogosphere. On today's roundtable, is the president trying to tackle too many issues at once? Our bloggers weigh in. Plus, the number of black state lawmakers reaches record levels, and the U.S. Supreme Court limits the reach of the Voting Rights Act of 1965. With us, Brandon Whitney of the blog Homeland Colors. He also writes about politics for the websites Black Men in America and My Voice DC. Political and social opinion writer Sophia Nelson, she's editor-in-chief of the Political Intersection blog, and Mark Lamont Hill, a professor of American Studies at Temple University. He blogs at marklamonthill.com and at The Root. Hello, everybody.
How you doing?
Hey, good to be here.
Great, nice to have you. Now, on MSNBC on Monday, former General Electric CEO Jack Welch lambasted President Obama, saying he lacked focus and was sending out a muddled message on the economy.
This guy has locked in another world, and he's throwing all these initiatives into this game in the middle of a crisis. Focus on the economy.
Welch went on to say that people who broach even the slightest criticism of President Obama do so at the peril of becoming pariahs in New York City. So, Mark, here's the question. There are two points that he is making here. One, that Obama is losing focus, and two, that you can't say that Obama is losing focus. Is he right?
I'd say yes and no. I think the first part, is Obama losing, actually rather no and yes. So is Obama losing focus? No. There's no way that you can talk about long-term financial stability without talking about shoring up energy issues, shoring up educational issues. That's how we ensure that long-term America will be more independent and more financially stable. Now, the question, though, is can you offer a public critique of Barack Obama and not be subject to a certain type of public scrutiny and maybe even demonization? I'm inclined to say he's right, and I don't think it's just exclusive to right-wingers. I think those of us on the left who have offered critique of Barack Obama have also been pushed to the margins a bit. I'm not going to say it's impossible. I don't want to be hyperbolic, but it's certainly difficult to offer a critique of him in the public square.
What about that, Sophia? Can you criticize the president, and does he need to be criticized about trying to do too many things at once?
Two points. Yes. First, I agree with Jack Welch, not necessarily his tone, but I think that he's right. I do think the president has taken on far too much. He wants an energy policy that's comprehensive. He wants a health care policy that's comprehensive. And he wants to do all this in the middle of a free-falling stock market. It did a little better yesterday, but it's, you know, not been so hot over the last month. Job losses at record highs. I think he needs to focus. And I do agree. And I would actually add in that if you're African-American and you criticize the president, you really catch heat. And no, it's true. I mean, people will get hostile with you, whether it's at church or wherever it is. If you say something bad about Barack Obama, it is not taken very well. And I think that's a little dangerous. I think that we ought to be able to criticize this president as we do any American president when he's not right.
You know, I know that that was certainly the case during the campaign, if you criticized Obama because of the euphoria over his historic run. But Brandon, since he's been in office, do you think the black people can't criticize the president in public?
Of course they can. I mean, it's a free country. Now, the problem I think Jack Welch has is that he wants to be able to criticize the president and not be criticized for his criticism. And it's a free country. You can say what you want to, and other people might find what you say to be foolish. I mean, I feel like Jack Welch is a CEO, and that's great. But there's a big difference between being a CEO and focusing on one thing, that is profits, and being a president and having multiple things that you have to focus on. He has to. When he decides to put something to the side, people can literally die. His opportunity cost isn't profit; it's people's lives. So when Jack Welch is trying to fix it so that Obama runs the country like he ran GE, I think it's a foolish and false analogy.
Well, let's talk about some of those multiple things that he's dealing with, Mark. Yesterday, the president marked his 50th day in office. Here's what he's been dealing with so far, okay? He's unveiled the first piece of his education plan, reversed restrictions on science and stem cell research, signed a huge stimulus package, announced a withdrawal of combat personnel from Iraq within the next 19 months. What's going to get fixed first?
Well, I mean, the first thing we have to understand is Barack Obama has teams of people in place. There is something to be said about public relations. He could certainly offer a different public image that suggests that he's focused exclusively on the economy, all hands are on deck, as it were, while other people focus on those other issues. But I think you're going to see the economy taken care of first, and I think many of these initiatives that he's working on are in direct conversation with, they're not competing agendas, they're in direct conversation with his economic plan. The stimulus plan is in direct relationship to the broader sort of economic concerns that we have. A long-term education plan, every statistic, studies suggest that long-term investment in education and educational access will improve the economy, will expand prosperity, and will help raise the floor upon which all Americans stand. The cap and trade not only improves our energy policy, but it also ultimately generates the tax revenue necessary to support a health care project. So there's this way in which these things are all interrelated, and it's almost disingenuous or naive of Jack Welch to suggest that he has too many irons in the fire.
All right, and also, Jack Welch has already demonstrated a lack of understanding of politics. He made an attempt to move into EU as his last effort as president, I believe, of GE, and his failure to understand the political situation in the EU prevented him from being successful in that. He doesn't understand politics, so I'm confused as to why they even have him up there speaking on political issues.
Well, he doesn't understand politics, but he understands economics and corporate governance and building a company and doing very well. He's a very wealthy man, and he's done very well for himself. He has a good business head, so I think to dismiss him as not understanding politics is a bit naive and disingenuous.
But those are two different skill sets.
The president of the United States needs to have that skill set right now, and the bottom line is this isn't about politics, and this is about this country moving forward. And if you look at the bills that have been presented that the president's going to sign, they are riddled with spending that has nothing to do with either the short-term or the long-term health of this economy recovering and creating jobs. It just has nothing to do with it.
I think that kind of speaks to my point, because he is the president. The Congress controls the earmarks. Although he hates the earmarks or doesn't want those earmarks, he has no choice if he wants that bill passed in a reasonable amount of time but to sign that. So those compromises are required. And if you're just looking at the bottom line like a CEO would, then that's okay. But if you're president and you have all of these different issues to focus on, you can't afford to be as pure in ideology as a businessman can.
Let
me ask all of you just to do this, because we're going to move on to another topic, and I want to get a grade from you. I know it's an oversimplification, but just for clarity's sake, in terms of how you think Barack Obama has performed as president so far on a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being like great, wonderful, what would you say, Mark?
I would say I'd give him a 7,
six and a half, seven. But yeah. Sophia?
7.
7. And Brandon?
I'd give him an 8.
An 8. All right, so he's passing.
You grade on the curve, brother.
He's passing.
I'm just playing. Sorry about that, Tony.
That's okay. That's all right. Let's move on to his coattails, actually, a little bit. President Obama, not the only black leader making history these days. As of last month, a record 5 African Americans are leading state legislative bodies, and the number of black state lawmakers has reached record levels. Do you think that Obama's ascendancy paved the way for a new path, for a new generation of black leaders? And is this part of the coattail effect, Sophia?
No, I think that they're separate. I mean, I think that we have seen a positive trend in the state legislatures, for example, particularly in the Northeast and some other regions where there are heavily populated groups of African Americans and people of color in the South. So we've seen those trends at the county and the state local level. And this was – it's generational. We've talked about this before. Gen X, which is my generation, is coming into power now. Obama is – kind of sort of Gen X. He's a little older. He's not old enough to be a boomer. But I think that the presidency is something that is separate and apart, because I still think all of us are a bit in awe and shock. I know I am, that we still have an African-American president. I still think I'm grappling with, wow, that's real. And I think that was something that happened a little bit quicker than we all expected that it might. But I think the trends in the state legislatures have been going in that direction, so I'm not at all surprised by this.
Well, Mark, on the other hand, while Mr. Obama's getting all the love, except for from Jack Welch at the moment, other black leaders are suffering publicly, like GOP National Committee Chairman Michael Steele, former Detroit Mayor Kwame Kilpatrick, New York Governor David Paterson. Are these men being measured against Obama, do you think?
I don't think you have to be measured against Obama necessarily to fail. I mean, Michael Steele measured against the chair I'm sitting in would be a failure based on his performance. Kwame Kilpatrick just got out of jail. I mean, you know, you don't need a sort of world historical figure like Barack Obama to make these guys look bad. I think these guys are doing well on their own. I think that people will ultimately be measured against Barack Obama, but I think the current cadre of particularly Republican black leadership is more about GOP reactionary tactics than it is anything to do with Barack Obama.
Well, I wonder, Brandon, do you think there's any legitimacy to the thought that the president's I don't want to say survival, but the president's just existence in that chair as a black person has changed the dynamic at all for other black politicians, and those who don't live up are going to pay a price?
Perhaps slightly. I think in the wider society, At large, it probably doesn't have as much of an effect. Nothing statistically significant.
You mean wider, W-I-D-E-R,
exactly,
right?
Thank you. But I think within the African-American community, it kind of helps in that we stop settling, you know. I think in a lot of different areas, we're just so happy to have somebody black in a position that we settle for anybody. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you have a guy who's mayor and he's text messaging somebody something he probably shouldn't be doing on a on his iPod or whatever you want to call it.
Absolutely.
You know, we settle for it. And I think we're starting to realize you don't have to settle for just anybody just because of the color of the skin. So I think perhaps in that way. But other than that, I mean, there are a lot of smart African-American people. And they know how to speak well, and they know how to run campaigns.
We're going to have
to skip
over one of the topics that we intended to talk about because we spent more time talking about earmarks than we had originally intended. And I want to get to this topic, even though it's a big left turn away from everything that we're discussing. It's Chris Brown. And the reason I want to do this is because I know that at least two of you, Sophia and Mark, have been blogging about this, and apparently a lot of others as well, in terms of what should happen to Chris Brown as a result of his alleged beating of Rihanna. Talk about what you are seeing on. Well, it's alleged until you're convicted.
I know better.
Okay, that's an important thing to remember.
It was emotional. I'm sorry.
But you know what? But see, that's the whole point. People have been responding emotionally on the blogs, haven't they? Sophia?
Well, let me say that I've got a couple pieces coming out on this that are more of a serious nature. I buried a girlfriend last week on March 5th. It was in the papers here locally in D.C. Pat Kelly was shot dead by her husband at church, the People's Church in Silver Spring, Maryland. Domestic violence was going on. None of us knew about it. She always looked like everything was okay. And so this is deeply personal for me, and it's coming at the same time that this Rihanna Chris Brown thing is going on. And I have two young nieces who think Rihanna's really cool and cute and listen to her music. And so it is emotional, and I think all of us should be much more emotional about the topic of domestic violence, particularly in the black community.
Now, Mark, I've got about 30 seconds for you to talk about what you've been writing on your blog.
You know, again, I've been taken aback a bit by the amount of, again, emotional investment that many of my readers have in this controversy. So many people taking sides, so many people trying to make sense of this, so many people begging Rihanna not to take them back, not just because of what it means for Rihanna, but what it means for the broader sort of representation of black womanhood in the public sphere. People are worried that if Rihanna takes Chris Brown back, that young black girls would think that an abusive relationship is acceptable. And the other thing very quickly that's disturbing is the way in which people keep looking for exculpatory narratives for Chris Brown. They're trying to find a reason to make him okay. You know, Rihanna must have done something wrong. Rihanna must have hit him with something. Rihanna must have started the fight. You know, looking for an excuse to make Chris Brown's behavior unacceptable. And these two competing narratives say a lot about gender relationships in our community and in broader American society.
All right, Brandon, I'm sorry I'm not going to have time to get your response on it. We'll try to do it again next time.
It was just been ditto anyway. So.
All right, we've been talking with Mark Lamont Hill, who teaches American Studies at Temple University. He blogs at marklamonthill.com and at The Root. Mark was at our New York studios. Brandon Whitney of the blog Homeland Colors. He joined us from our headquarters in Washington, D.C. And political and social opinion writer Sophia Nelson. She's editor-in-chief of the Political Intersection blog and was at member station WETA in Arlington, Virginia. Of course, you can find links to their blogs as well as to ours at NPRnewsandnotes.org. I'm Tony Cox, and this is News and Notes. Here is a question for our African American listeners. Are you embarrassed when a black public figure runs afoul of the law? Think Chris Brown, O.J. Simpson, R. Kelly, Kwame Kilpatrick. And whether you're black or not, has your attitude toward African Americans who are in the limelight changed since the election of President Obama? And do black public figures have to carry the weight of the race on their shoulders? Or has the emergence of Barack Obama changed that paradigm as well? Our regular contributor, Lynn Toler, has been musing on this subject. She is a black public figure, of course. She is the star of TV's Divorce Court. She joins us now. Hi, Lynn.
Hi, Tony. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. You know, for those of our listeners who are not African-American, Lynn, some context may be in order here. So help me explain what we're talking about. And you know, like being secretly relieved when some high-profile crime occurs and the perpetrator isn't black.
There's no secret relief at my house. My mother, who, you know, was born in the 30s, I can't say exactly when because she'll shoot me, but she would ask, was he black? Especially when it was a ball player, an athlete. She didn't know who they are. And she would be verbally and outright relieved when they weren't, because she was raised in an atmosphere of, I'm fighting to get out from under, and I don't have the luxury of being average, so you clearly don't have the luxury of failing on my behalf. And clearly during that time, even when I was young, you know, back in the 1950s and the 60s, it was part of the they can't make it. If you fail, you felt like you failed for everyone. And I don't think that's as true anymore. But I think people of my age and my parents' generation certainly grew up with that feeling that Hattie McDaniel expressed when she got that Oscar.
Now, by the same token, Lynn, black public figures, and you're one, have felt that pressure, haven't they?
Yes, we do. We very, very often feel that pressure because there's always going to be a strata of society says, yes, there's another example. It's another rule. And when you're better than average, you're an exception to the rule, and it doesn't seem to help as much as doing the wrong thing hurts.
You know, let me ask you this, because I think that there is a different situation now, and I'd like for you to speak to it. For example, O.J. Simpson was a racial lightning rod, but others, from Michael Jackson to Michael Vick to now Chris Brown and Charles Barkley, they haven't seemed to be saddled with that same racial animus/obligation. Am I right about that?
I think you're very right, and I think that's twofold. One, we are aging out of that generation where we as black people had to convince white folks that we were just as human as they were. And a lot of that generation has died out, and we have that generation X there. And also, there are so many more shooting stars. I mean, it's not just Jackie Robinson anymore. You look at the NFL or the NBA or the judges on court shows, you see a lot of black people. The president is black. It is not that unusual to have someone black. I mean, Flip Wilson was something back in the day when he did what he did, but you see black people on TV in positive roles more regularly now, and especially on the athletic front. So it isn't so much a black thing anymore. It's an individual thing.
And it certainly seems that the younger generation has not bought into any of that. And I wonder, you've already described in part that it's because of perhaps more exposure to blacks in different contexts. But the young folks, this isn't an issue for them, is it?
I don't think it's an issue for them, for a couple of reasons. I think we as a society, black and white, have lost a contact with the shame button. I mean, there's from Britney Spears to whoever to Mel Gibson, whatever. You go on a contrition tour, I'm sorry, but there seems to be you can act up a little more and everybody kind of pats you on the back and it's okay. And I think that there are so many of us out here now who are making it on an individual basis. It's not seen as Charles Barkley represents black folks when he says or when he does. He's seen as Charles Barkley, which is an advance on our part. I mean, which is a good thing. But also, sometimes I wish we would keep that sense of
outrage.
I want to do better for us, and I want to give a positive example simply because some little kid might be watching and see me as his role model. I mean, Charles Barkley said, I am not a role model. Yeah, he is. He's just not a good one. Yeah. So, you know what I'm saying? And I love Charles Barkley because I appreciated the fact that he said he wasn't going to live up that standard. I'm a big guy that can throw a ball, and that's all you can expect from me. But I would love it if we black public figures wanted more for art.
Well,
on a larger scale.
This certainly puts the Chris Brown, Rihanna thing right center stage, and it seems as if this has the potential to be an incident that could raise that level of consciousness, but it doesn't appear from what I have read and heard and seen so far that it is necessarily doing that.
I don't think it is. I've done a couple of radio shows on it, and the callers that come in, I mean, with the exculpatory material for Chris Brown and telling me, you know, if black women weren't so rageful and would act like feminine people, this would never happen to them, which is a complete misunderstanding of domestic violence, and have a need to defend, like, you know, the OJ, well, black men are under fire, so we will defend at all costs, even when a black woman is the victim of his failures. I think we are seeing a lot of that with Chris Brown and Rihanna.
Do you think that, and I know that you're not a part of the judicial case here, but from what you've been reading about that case, does it appear as if this is a good one for some sort of out-of-court a plea bargain? That's what I'm trying to say.
Whoa, that is very difficult. I lived in a no-drop. When I was doing domestic violence, we didn't drop it even if the woman didn't want to continue. We would go based upon the evidence of the phone call, her condition, the police, and we didn't care if she wanted to drop it or not because we thought it was such a social ill and a pariah of such magnitude that whether or not she forgave him, we didn't. So it's really hard to say without knowing the specifics of the case.
Well, Judge, I just want to thank you for coming on and talking about this with us and coming on all the weeks. As you know, this is our last time together with you on News and Notes. Our show is coming to an end, and I wanted to say on the air for all the listeners and for all the staff here at News and Notes how much we have enjoyed having you on, and we hope that you have found the experience as enjoyable as we have.
It was wonderful. I really appreciate the opportunity to share my opinions on a variety of subjects. I still do it on JudgeLynn.com where I blog, and I thank you so much. I have enjoyed every moment of it.
Judge Lynn Toler again. Thank you very much. Judge Lynn Toler is the star of TV's Divorce Court. She is also the author of My Mother's Rules, A Practical Guide to Becoming an Emotional Genius. She joined us from the studios of KJZZ in Tempe, Arizona.
Alvin Ailey, the legendary African-American dancer and choreographer, died 20 years ago, but his influence and legacy has continued to grow internationally. His groundbreaking troupe, the Alvin Ailey Dance Theater, turns 50 this year. Joining us to talk about this milestone is Nasha Thomas-Schmidt. She's the co-director of the Ailey Arts and Education Program. Hi, Nasha.
Good afternoon. How are you?
I'm good. Now, this is great because I love Alvin Ailey. I've been a fan all my life. And you were a principal dancer for 12 years?
I was, yes.
What was that like to dance with this amazing company?
It was a phenomenal experience. I grew up in New York City in Queens and studied at the Ailey School and left for school in California, worked in Italy a little bit. And when I came home and got to audition for the company and was chosen by Mr. Ailey, it was kind of like a dream come true.
Really? And so now you obviously, you met him, you knew him.
I did. I was hired by Mr. Ailey, auditioned, and was chosen out of about 50 other participants, which was a small audition at that time, and then continued working with Miss Jamison when she took over as artistic director.
Got you. Now, watching this company grow as it has and they have this international appeal, it has amazing international appeal.
Right.
Are you surprised by that? I mean, why is that?
You know, I really am not. I think that Alvin was truly a visionary. He had, you know, this love for dance. He was very talented. And he had a story that he wanted to tell that is universal. You know, it really, the company represents modern dance in the African-American tradition, but the works that Alvin Ailey started choreographing when he put together the company really represent feelings and emotions and happenings that celebrate the life experience. And there are things that we can all relate to. So when the company is performing in China or Los Angeles or Italy, the ballets that are being performed are pieces that can be enjoyed and understood and felt really, you know, I think deeply by everyone that is seeing them.
Well, it's very interesting because I've always noticed with the group that you've always sort of had this very stable, very huge support system. Even when other dance companies have sort of, you know, sort of lagged behind in sales or whatever, Ailey has been really, really good.
I think a part of it is definitely is Alvin and his appeal. People liked him and he liked people. People were drawn to him and his message that he was sending through his company. The company, of course, is supported by a phenomenal board and our executive director, Sharon Luckman, and our artistic director, Judith Jamison. But it is really the public that has helped the company sustain. And Judith Jamison, you know, believes, as a lot of us believe, you surround yourself with people that are smarter in ways that you're not smart, people that can help you do the job that needs to be done, because we all have our special areas of talent. And it's just an incredible organization from all aspects, from the administration to the people that come. And it is really about presenting a company and works and programs, be it our educational programs at the school or our ALEI camps like the one here in Los Angeles that's funded by the Gloria Kaufman Dance Foundation. Programs and performances of excellence, and that is really what it's about.
Well, that's what I wanted to ask you, because this is the milestone, the 50-year milestone, which is incredible. And the company has evolved so much. Is that what you're proudest of, some of the outreach programs?
I think Alvin always wanted his company to be accessible and the organization to be accessible. There are people that come in to see us because they love the performances. There are people that come in to see us because they want to train and learn dance techniques. There are people that come to see us because they want to have the outreach experience. They bring us into their communities and we go to these communities. It is an organization that is multifaceted, and I think that that is definitely the thing that has made us so popular, for lack of another word. We do a lot of things, but at the core, we are accessible. We have things that support and give back to the community, and that's what Alvin really wanted to do when he started the company. He said he believed dance came from the people, and it should be delivered back to the people. So whether it's through performances, or our BFA program, or our ALEI camp, or our arts and education residencies, or ALEI 2, it is really about giving back.
Now, what's also amazing is you said it's all about Alvin in many ways and his presence, and he's been gone for 20 years.
Right.
That's amazing, because I think with another kind of person, would that have been possible?
Well, I think with any, you know, we've seen a lot of dance companies lose their founder. Judith Jamison is a dynamic woman. She was an incredible performer. She is a personality. And she was very, very close with Alvin, working artistically. She is known for many of his ballets, Umbrella and Wade in the Water and Cry, and, you know, and other ballets. She is just, she's a visionary in her own right, you know, and I think she was the best person to take over in his departure. But Judy has been a true leader.
Okay.
And I think that, as she has said, Alvin left a map, a groundwork for us to follow. And although it has been, she's almost celebrating her 20th anniversary this actually December, I'm sure it has been something that has been a work of love for her.
Okay.
It has been something that she has been able to do easily because of her background, what she has, her place in the company and the organization, and what he had left.
Well, now let's talk about my favorite part of Alvin Ailey and my favorite dance of Ailey, Revelations, which has been seen, I guess the dance has been seen by more people
than any other ballet in the world, in the dance world.
What is it about that particular dance that is so uplifting and wonderful? And you can't forget it. When you see it, you never forget it.
Audiences can't forget it. Performers never get tired of performing it. And again, it is about an experiences that we have all felt. The actual action of the experience is different. But Alvin Ailey, who grew up in a small town in Texas where it was very hot, he attended a Baptist church, he was raised by a single parent, he had all of these things that he called blood memories. And he created this ballet, he choreographed this ballet with this story of his life, you know, and he was born in 1931, experienced the Great Depression, experienced segregation. Here we are in 2009, and we have a major financial crisis around the world. There are experiences that we are all having, but a ballet like Revelations makes all of those different experiences one universal experience where we all can celebrate the hardships.
Thank you so much, Nasha.
You're welcome.
That was Nasha Thomas-Schmidt. She's the co-director of the ALEI Arts and Education Program. She joined us here in the studios of NPR West in Culver City.